Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10x points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions.
Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. In recent weeks, we've really focused on some ways that listeners can boost their income. So whether that's through starting your own side business and growing your network like Holla talked about, or when we talked with local realtor Alan about diving into investing in real estate, well, what better way to test the waters? While you are away, your home could also earn extra income.
That's right. Your empty space could be an Airbnb while you're traveling, because that's all you need to become an Airbnb host. It's a lot easier than you think, and you don't need to Airbnb your entire house. You could just host your extra spare room. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. All you do is start with a prompt. You describe your presentation in a few words, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides that you can then customize in seconds.
Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation with AI.
Generate slides in seconds with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're talking personal finance for geniuses with Adam Nash.
So we're not speaking in hyperbole to say that we're talking about money, but for geniuses. Yeah, that's because our guest today, Adam Nash, he is an adjunct lecturer at Stanford University, which is, of course, full of very smart folks.
I've heard that.
You got GPAs, you got SAT scores that are super high. Is a course on money, is that even necessary? That is some of what we'll discuss today. But Adam is more than just a personal finance enthusiast. His career spans roles at companies like Dropbox, eBay, and even Apple, just to name a few that I literally use on a daily basis. And he's currently serving as the CEO. He's the co-founder of Daffy, which is a fintech platform centered around charitable giving. So even though it's not December, we're also going to talk about strategically giving your money away. Adam, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great to be here.
We're glad to have you, Adam. This is going to be really, really fun combo. The first question, though, that we have to ask, we ask everybody who comes on the show, is what's your craft beer equivalent? That's because Matt and I spend maybe too much money, some would say, on craft beer. But we don't think it's too much because we're still doing the smart stuff, saving and investing for our future. So what is it that maybe you spend more money than some people would think is sane on in the current moment, but you're still doing the right thing with your money for the long term?
Well, you know, I have a few hobbies, as it turns out, but I'm a big believer in having a couple splurges, something that you feel comfortable spending a little bit on to remind you of, you know, what the money's for and enjoying life.
Yes.
The problem is, you know, I'm kind of a big nerd, so my things may not be as cool as craft beer. My first splurge, actually, I remember when LinkedIn went public. My first splurge was I stopped worrying about buying books. So I used to always have this thing where, like, do I have time to read it? Is it worth it, etc.? Now, last 10 years, if someone recommends a book to me, I just order it on Amazon. I have the book.
You don't even go used. I like that.
He doesn't even check the Libby app or Hoopla to see if he can.
I just buy the book. I love books. I love my bookshelves. You know, I love having them. I love having stacks of books around. My wife is fairly tolerant of piles of books building up everywhere. But yeah, my big splurge is that when anyone recommends a book to me, says it's amazing, they loved it, etc., I just order it right away on my phone.
Okay. I love it. Do you ever use audiobooks or is it all print?
You know, I don't. I never really adapted to audiobooks. I enjoy reading. And I love printed pages. I don't do ebooks.
So you're not even rocking like a paper, what is it, like a Paperwhite, the Kindle or whatever?
You know, I can't, for some reason, I don't focus the same way. Hmm. There's something, maybe it's just the way I was brought up and read, but you know, my ability to get lost in a physical book for even 20, 30, 60 minutes is just very, very different than when I'm using a device, and sure why.
The smell of the paper, the ink perhaps, the parchment, all of it combined.
That's right. There's something there.
Makes Adam a perpetual learner.
Yeah.
Adam, let's talk about your story, because you've been in the space of making financial tools more accessible. When did you know that this was the direction you wanted to go in, or was it more of a gradual process? Was there an epiphany one morning when you woke up and decided on that? Share some of your background, please.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to. And my background isn't that unusual for Silicon Valley, right? I came out of school with a couple of degrees in engineering and a real focus on what was called human-computer interaction, which is all about the ways that, you know, people interact with technology, right? Technology is very rigid. It's very logical. It's ones and zeros. It works or it doesn't work. Humans, we have emotions. We have feelings. It's not about the specifics as much as about, you know, what we feel like we're doing. And so I was always fascinated with this growing use of technology in more and more spheres of our life. And so that's what I dedicated my career to. And so almost every company I've been at has been something exciting where technology was entering a new area. You know, eBay, you know, building marketplaces where, you know, small businesses around the world could sell their products and services, or people could sell to each other. LinkedIn was all about giving people the tools to manage their own professional lives and careers. But in 2012, I discovered this new category that we now call fintech. Which was really about, hey, how do we solve financial problems for people in software? And that's how I ended up being the CEO of Wealthfront for a number of years. And so for the last 10 years or more, I've been very much focused on how can we use software to help people with their financial lives.
I love it. Yeah, and I love how you talk about kind of the personality that you can give to technology, which is typically a little more rigid. And we're going to talk about the company that you currently run, right, called Daffy, in a little bit, but you've done a great job with that. I think the interface is very engaging for people who want to invest dollars to give away in the future. But with all of your history in Silicon Valley, you've worked for a bunch of great companies. Matt rattled some of them off at the beginning. I'd love to hear from you, though. What in your mind, and running multiple companies as well, what does it take to build a great company?
Oh, it's a very difficult problem, because, like, let's be clear, running a company is a difficult problem, right? There's no one who runs a business. I don't care what business. You're doing a media business, you have a restaurant, a technology company. Running a business is difficult, and it's competitive. And every year, the game changes, right? Nothing's standing still. You can't just do the same thing 1 year that you did the previous year. But when you're trying to build a brand new company, it's doubly hard, more than doubly hard. Because you're trying to enter a market, right? Why, out of all the thousands of millions of companies and businesses out there, why does the world need another one, right? And so this area of how do you build a new product and service, a new offering, build up a new customer base, really a hard problem. Now, I think the good news is in the last 50 years, thanks to Silicon Valley and a number of other folks involved, we've learned better the patterns of how to build new technology companies. And there's a reason why technology companies are a little bit easier in some ways to build. And that's because technology constantly is giving this gift of new things that are possible today that weren't really possible 10 years ago. Right? Moore's Law, Metcalfe's Law, whatever your favorite way of thinking about how technology progresses. The reality is that you could take a brilliant person today with modern software and modern hardware, give them the same problem that someone was given 10 years ago, and they'll come up with a new answer because the computers keep getting faster, the technology keeps getting better. And so things that used to be very, very expensive all of a sudden become almost free. Right. And so that applies everywhere. And so when I approach these companies, almost all these companies that I've been a part of represented this frontier of, like, hey, technology used to not be able to help us with this problem, but maybe now it can. And that's extended across, like I said, e-commerce, you know, buying and selling things, people's careers, how we socialize with each other. And then, of course, managing money. Turns out to be one of these areas where we used to have to do it by hand and hire people to help us do this. And some people still do. But the tools and the services to help us manage our own money keep getting better every year, every decade. And I just find that very exciting and empowering.
Absolutely. And with the dawn of technology and how that allows us to maybe invest smarter or save more strategically, there are certain fundamentals and certain principles that don't change quite as much. And on that note, you teach a personal finance class basically at Stanford. Why do you think personal finance is normally like held in such low esteem? Like it almost seems like something that institutions, they just assume that you should already know this, or they assume that this is something that, oh, by the way, you're just going to kind of figure this out on your own. Or maybe we'll leave it to your employer. Depends if you've got someone great manning HR. Maybe they'll give you a few pointers on how much you should set aside from your paycheck. I guess I'd like to hear your thoughts on sort of the state of personal finance education and how it's viewed today.
Yeah, well, I have a very strong opinion about this. I think it's insane that we take children, we take young adults and throw them into the world and an economy where there's such a complexity about not just financial products, but how to make all these financial decisions. And we give them no background or grounding to do it. Most people learn personal finance the same way that they learn about careers. I used to say at LinkedIn, right? It's, you know, you're basically limited to this world, which is, you know, the parents of your friends and the friends of your parents, which is not the right way to help educate people. I do think part of it is ironically because personal finance isn't that difficult academically. So I think when you get people who are very smart, they have 120 IQs, 140 IQs, 160 IQs, they tend to put personal finance into a corner as if it isn't worth their time.
Yeah.
But listen, I don't care how high your IQ is. If you don't know what a credit card is or how it functions, or you don't know what a mortgage is or how to think about a financial problem about, you know, saving for your kid's college education, you have to learn it somehow. And I wish that it was as simple as doing your own research and just searching the internet. But it turns out that there are trillions of dollars in the world. And that means that there's trillions of reasons for the internet to get flooded with sales information about all these financial products and services, which frankly are not set up to be good for you, or at least good for everyone. And so for me, the class was a big piece of giving back. It's the class I wish existed when I was in school. And I've actually opened up the material publicly so that other schools and other areas, I'm hoping that more and more institutions will borrow the material and use it to teach more and more students, you know, what they need to know before they go out into the world and start making money themselves.
And we'll put a link to all those slides, all that content in the show notes for this episode, because I agree, especially as personal finance education becomes more mandatory in high schools across the country, teachers are going to need curriculum to kind of help their students understand personal finance. They might not know exactly how to go about teaching those classes. And I think this is going to be an invaluable resource. I mean, we've got a lot of personal finance educators who listen to this podcast who teach at schools around the country. So I'm sure they'll find that really helpful. I'm curious, Matt, Adam, when you start the class, you just mentioned a bunch of like nuts and bolts personal finance topics that you cover, but that's not actually where you start. You actually start talking about behavioral finance. Why is that like essentially the first or second class that you begin the course with, is talking about kind of our behavioral anomalies?
Well, the reason I start with behavioral finance, with emotions, with psychology, is because I actually think that's not only the hardest problem for most people when they're dealing with money in their own lives, but it's also where most people get tripped up, right? When we look at money, we want to think of it as dollars and cents. It's just numbers. It's just math. It should be very rational. But money is tied up in a lot of things that we care deeply about. Money is rarely the goal by itself. It's a means to an end, though, for a lot of the things that we care about in life, things that we care about for ourselves, for our loved ones, for how we evaluate our success, etc. And so I always start with behavioral finance. I also do it because, you know, there's been a lot of good progress. You know, when I was in school 30 years ago, there wasn't as much academic credibility around behavioral finance. There hadn't been Nobel Prizes in the area, which there are now. And so I think there's a greater understanding about how emotions lead people to make poor financial decisions. And so I always like to start the class, especially with young people. They tend to feel like they're immortal. They can do anything, all this optionality. They also have a little bit of anxiety about going out into the world. And I find it's a really great place to start to get them to open up and just admit the fact that they have feelings about money, that they have feelings about success, and they have fear and they have aspiration. And so by going through the emotions, then when we're talking about, you know, what does it mean to earn money? What does it mean to save money? Why is it so hard not to spend more than you make? Why is it so hard to invest properly? The emotional background, the psychology background helps them, I think, deal with those decisions and understand why very smart people might do very different things in the same situation.
Plus, if you start with budgeting, you're going to put them to sleep, and that just like ruins the whole rest of the course. So.
Well, I just love the idea of starting with vulnerability because it makes everything else so much more real.
Yeah.
Because if you are able to tap into some of those emotions, then all of a sudden this has gone from something that was super boring and maybe how they expected their dad to talk about it to something that, oh, wow, all of a sudden this is something that matters to them on a like on a deeper level.
Oh, for sure. And what I find is that the students have a lot of questions. In fact, right after we cover behavioral finance, the next topic I cover, which most personal finance courses don't, is I actually cover compensation, earning money. Right? You find that so much content out there in personal finance is about how to control your spending, how to pay mm-hmm. off your debt, how to buy a house. And these are all very important financial goals, and they're important. But I actually like to start with compensation, how people earn money, and what does that look like? And in fact, these are students at Stanford, of course, so they have a lot of very high-end opportunities coming out of school. Mm-hmm. But no one's actually talked to them about what that offer letter is going to look like. You know, what is the difference between salary and a bonus? What is the difference between hourly pay or an exempt salary? What are stock options? What's restricted stock? A lot of these students go off to work in technology. And so I find that by starting with income, it gets kind of people's energy going.
Yeah.
And I think there's a real lesson there. For a lot of people, it's easier for them to think of ways to make more money than it is for them to think of ways to spend less.
Yeah.
And both are important for financial success. But I do find starting with compensation gets people's energy going. And then we can get into... you described as budgeting. I tend to talk about, you know, that basics of, you know, how do you make sure you spend less than you make, right? That basic budget, and some of the downsides of budgets. And then we go into assets and we talk about debt. And only then do we get into the topic that everyone wants to talk about, which is investing and how to turn some of those savings into more money over time and compounding, et cetera. So,
okay, you just hinted at the downsides of budgeting. I'm curious to hear your take on that. What, you know, that, because that is typically chapter number one in every personal finance book. It starts the boring rote way talking about budgeting. Matt is more of a budgeter than I am. We talked about on the show. I'm a more free spirit. Matt's more technical, loves his spreadsheets, can tell you what he spent on groceries back in 2007. That's how nerdy he gets. But yeah, tell me, what in your view, what are the downsides of budgeting?
Oh, Matt is my people. I have a Quicken file that goes back to 1994. So I think
a little
up on that. But
I love it.
But no, listen, I'm very positive on budgeting because I think the research that I've seen pretty much indicates that even though most people don't stick to their budget, people who budget or at least look at their expenses on a semi-regular basis end up spending less money than people who don't. So I'm net positive on budgeting, but it turns out mental accounting, this is one of those biases that we talk about in behavioral finance, mental accounting, when you bucket money, it's very powerful. It can lead you to do things you wouldn't normally do. So for example, if you make a monthly budget where you set aside, I don't know, $300 a month for clothing, there's a lot of people who get to the, you know, the last week of the month and they realize that they didn't spend $300 on clothing this month and they almost feel like they're supposed to. Right. And they actually end up going out and buying sunglasses or, you know, an outfit or that sort of thing. When in reality, the truth was they didn't actually need to spend that money on clothing that month. And maybe they would need a little more in a future month. And so budgets have a funny way. I think high level budgets are good. I think it's wonderful to go through your finances regularly and see what you're spending money on. My wife and I actually do an annual meeting
Yes.
where we talk through our finances once a year. But I do think there's a problem with budgeting where in some ways you can start working for the budget and it can lead you to make some financial decisions that aren't necessarily the right ones.
Yeah. I think a lot of times budgets are not rooted in hopes, goals, and dreams too. And so often, I don't know, we just kind of look at what we spent last month. We try to make our budget accommodate that. And I think, Matt, this is, you changed my view on budgeting when you kind of talked about, well, no, it's supposed to fuel the things that you want to achieve in life. And so much of it comes back down to that behavioral, that why, what, you know, what's the money for to begin with? And I think once we're able to do that, connect the dots, the budget becomes less of a burden and more of like, oh, wow, look at what I'm working towards.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I'm definitely a fan of frameworks that use things like wants and needs, right? Like, I do think that the value of budgets, a lot of people have different levels of anxiety about money, which really comes down to sometimes how they were brought up, but also the anxiety that can come from not having money for the things that are most important to them. And a lot of people don't actually give that a lot of thought. What actually is important to you? A lot of couples never have that discussion, right? It comes out in arguments. It comes out in panic. It comes out in moments where you're worried about things. But the truth is, if you're at all introspective, you can be honest about the expenses. For some people, they would feel like a failure if they didn't provide for their kids' college education. Right? It's not a rational thing. Something happened to them growing up. Maybe they had to struggle to pay for it themselves, and they wanted to believe that their children wouldn't have to struggle the same way. Or maybe actually their parents covered their college education. They feel like they wouldn't be doing as well as their parents if they didn't cover it for their children. Whatever the reason is, mm-hmm. It's not rational. It's an emotional response. It's a judgment. But we don't give enough space for us to talk about the things that give us life, both joy and things that we would regret if we didn't do. And so I'm a big fan of people being open and honest about these things, making that list of not just the things that they need, but also the things that are important to them, and make sure that their financial goals actually line up with what's going to bring them the most reward emotionally.
I love that. That's such a, I think, a healthy, holistic approach to money, right? As opposed to, in regards to your overall class and how you are approaching personal finances, you're not telling folks to, all right, let's start with the nuts and bolts, and this is how you need to start investing. Because if you were to focus on some of those specific skills, what you're doing is creating a class of practitioners, of a bunch of people who know how to do certain things with their money, but they don't know why they're doing those things. And we try to take a step back and connect individuals with, like you said, why it is that they're saving and investing, why it is that they're choosing not to spend some money in certain ways. It's more like a classical liberal arts sort of approach to like zoom out and to be able to see the entire forest and to understand why it is that you're doing these things, because then that can fuel the inevitable roadblocks and hurdles that we encounter that causes us to kind of fall off the wagon and ditch the budget in the first place.
Well, that's right. And you have to leave room. Like I said, what's the money for, right? Like, the reason people always struggle between the future and the present and what they're doing right now versus what's coming down the road is they don't tend to ask those questions to think clearly about what's really important to them. But you know, the day-to-day is important too. You need to live your life, right? You know, I'm a big fan of thinking of these problems. Like I said, I encourage people to think about how they can make more money or what they do for a living, or being honest about the career path that they're going down, not just pros and cons, but what kind of life it builds for them. I really think that for most people, they're really trying to build a life. It's not a number in their bank account. It's not anything specific, not one action or one goal. There's a certain life that people want to live that brings them more joy. It also gives them more fulfillment. They feel good. Some of the happiest people I know are working incredibly hard, but they're incredibly motivated and inspired by what they're doing. And so I encourage the class to think of it that way, to go beyond the actual dollars and cents themselves to what they're actually fighting for. What do they want to do? But it is very important that they learn the math. It's very important that they actually learn how the numbers work, because there are some decisions that you make that seem like just small decisions, but actually can be very expensive, right? I mean, when we talk about investing, right, it turns out fees and taxes are actually very expensive mistakes that people make. We live in a country where if you hold a stock for 364 days, that tax rate will be much higher than 365 days. That's not a law of nature. That's a rule we made up, but it is a real rule. And so I try to have the class be a blend of kind of knowing how to do the math to find the right answer, but then also ask the questions of what is your priority and what are you trying to do with your life?
Yeah, no, you got to run the gamut. You got to do both, and you got to talk about the ins and outs of, well, if you buy the new car versus the 8-year-old used car, how much is that going to, you know, cost you in terms of monthly payment, let's say, or not being able to pay cash for it, and then all the other additional costs that go along with buying the newer car, higher interest rates right now, all that kind of stuff should factor into the discussion. You talk about savings rate too, Adam, and that's one of the things you hone in on, and you actually criticize the 10% blanket suggestion that most folks tend to give. I'm curious, because most folks tend to save less than that in the United States of America. So 10% is actually a high bar for many people who aren't hitting that yet. Why is that too little, though, and what's the ideal savings rate in your opinion?
Well, I don't know if I'm negative on it as much as I joke about it. I am a fan of 10%. It's better than 9%. And not as good as 11. But my joke in the class very much is that, you know, there's no mathematical background for the 10%. It really just comes down to the fact that humans like the number 10. I mean, we have 10 fingers, right?
Yeah, like yeah. 10 toes as well.
It's like, know? Jerry Maguire. It's like, why do agents charge 10%? Why is everything 10? We just like 10. We have 10 fingers. Yeah. I feel bad. I feel like Mickey and Minnie probably only save 8%. You know, one less finger on each hand. But no, so what I teach in my class, though, is that the real answer is that it's a marathon, not a sprint, and that every single percent that you save, right, that you spend less than you make, is a win on both sides of the equation, right? On the one hand, you're learning to live on less, right? So when you save 10%, it means you're learning to live on 90% of your salary, which means that your goal doesn't have to be as high. You don't have to replace all your income in retirement. You just have to replace 90%. And the great thing is that every percent you save also gives you more capital to hit that goal. So you have more money to hit your goal, and you've actually reduced the goal. And so I really encourage people to think of ways they can always move that number up to a reasonable place, right? You know, and because a lot of young people, a lot of students come out of the class, they can't save 10%. They come out, they save 3%, 4%, 5%, and they get discouraged. They shouldn't get discouraged, right? If every year they move that number up a percent or two, right? They don't spend that cost of living adjustment. They get a promotion and they don't spend the promotion dollars. They can very quickly get to a place where they're saving 10% or more. Yeah. And remember, a lot of my class are engineers. They're going to Silicon Valley. These are folks who are not the average American in terms of compensation. They're actually going to come out of school and make more than the average household on day one. They should be able to save more if they don't get into bad habits of spending everything they make and more, which is why I try to hit that topic as hard as I do in the class.
That makes sense. Try to keep that spending in check. Well, Adam, we've got more to get to. We're kind of talking about personal finance, like 101 essentially to a certain extent here, but we want to talk about something that's maybe a little more advanced, giving your money away, and donor advised funds. They're not just for the richy rich type folks out there. It's something that's possible and available to all folks. We'll talk about that and more right after this.
Kachava is the all-in-one superfood shake made up of high-quality plant-based nutrients. It's got greens, superfruits, plant proteins, antioxidants, adaptogens, probiotics, and in other words, everything your body craves to feel your best. This is where Kachava really earns their 52,000 plus five-star reviews. It tastes amazing. It's creamy and smooth with just water, and it comes in five delicious flavors. You can choose from chocolate, vanilla, chai, matcha, and coconut acai. Kachava is offering How to Money listeners 10% off for a limited time. I've been using Kachava in breakfast smoothies in the morning recently. It's just so nice to pack in a bunch of nutrients early in the AM in a way that's satisfying and energizing. So if you want to optimize your breakfast, your workout shake, be sure to check out Kachava. Just go to kachava.com/howtomoney. That's spelled K-A-C-H-A-V-A, and get 10% off your first order. That's K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com/howtomoney.
When it comes to financial advice, you gotta trust the source. That's why you listen to this podcast. And if you're looking to upgrade your wallet, you need to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. If you're paying for vacations with whatever card is in your wallet, you could be missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table.
You can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade, lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions.
Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week at the beach. Every single summer, we've already got that trip to St. Simon's on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host, or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. All right, we're back from the break. We're still talking with Adam Nash, the CEO of Daffy, a super cool donor advised fund app and website. We'll get into specifics on that in just a second. But Adam, I'm curious, we were just talking about 10%, the kind of artificially constructed advised savings rate that so many personal finance aficionados have come up with, and how that's, you know, not one size fits all, and that can change across time. Let's talk about giving now. That's also, I think, the knee-jerk response. Well, how much money should you give? Well, 10% of your income. And that has, I think, a lot to do with religious tradition, tithing being one of those. How do you think about giving? As someone who runs an app and is really intentional about how they give their money away, how do you think about and, you know, give people advice on how much money they should be giving away?
It's funny you ask this question. So before we wrote one line of code, before we had even actually incorporated the company, I spent some time talking to dozens of people across the country about how they think about giving. And what I was hoping for was a simple answer to that question of what is the right amount to give. But it turns out if you ask about 20 Americans, what's the right number to give, you get about 20 answers. And they're not even numbers. Some people think of it as a percentage. Some people think of it as an absolute amount, like you should give at least $500 to charity every year. Some people think it has to do with how good your year was. It's almost like, it's almost like in Las Vegas, like tipping the dealer when you have a good night or that sort of thing. People have good years and not so good years. So what really struck me was that there wasn't one answer about the right number. What I did find that was very universal, however, was that almost everyone I talked to believed that giving was important. They had been taught, someone in their life, a teacher, a parent, a rabbi, a priest, someone had taught them along the way that life wasn't meant to be 100% selfish, that there's other people around you, and that there are people who have it worse than you do, and that it is a good thing to get out of your own needs and your own day-to-day and put something aside for those less fortunate than yourself. And so I found that was very universal, even though the amounts weren't. And so for most people, when they ask me about giving, I say the most important thing about giving is just to give, just to put some money aside. And in fact, Daffy, right, the app that we built, is very non-judgmental about the amount, right? You wanna put aside $10 a week for charity? Great. You wanna fund an account with stock or crypto, because that's a smart tax move, that's also great. Any reason that gets you to put money aside for charity, we consider a good thing. And then the giving we find comes naturally. We're often inspired to give on a regular basis, not just to organizations, but for things that really touch us. The big problem, I think, for most people on giving is not the giving piece, it's the budgeting problem. It's this feeling of like, well, I don't know how much I can afford to give. And that's one of the reasons we built Daffy, was just to take that problem off the table for people and let them be the inspired, generous people that we think most people want to be.
It can be a part of their plan to be generous, which at some point in their life, like you said, they've been taught that that is important. I'm also bummed to hear that y'all haven't incorporated like a frowny face if you're only going to set aside $5 a week, you know, and then whoever is setting aside the...
a gentle chiding, you know?
Or like at least a judgmental, you know, side eye or something like that. Come on.
No. What we lean into in the product is on the inspiration side, right? And by the way, this is not that different than retirement savings. What do you tell people with their 401k is that to, every year to think about nudging up that percentage that they put aside for retirement, like maybe 1% more. We do the same things with giving, right? We let people set a giving goal and be very intentional, right? If you give a few hundred dollars to charity every year, maybe to your church or synagogue, maybe your kid's school, maybe your alma mater, maybe it's a national cause you support. There's some number that you spent on giving last year. Why not put that number down, make it a goal, and then we celebrate when you hit that goal. And of course, we celebrate even more when you exceed that goal. And then guess what? Next year, we'll probably say, hey, you were so generous last year. Why don't you be even more generous this year? And so for us, it's less about what you give today or now, and more getting into that pattern, that habit of giving, which you can then grow over time.
I love that. It's the discipline of doing the action. Adam, we've talked about donor-advised funds before, but can you give like a quick overview of what a donor-advised fund is, and then maybe why it is that folks should actually utilize that donor-advised fund as opposed to, say, just giving directly to an organization?
Sure, happy to. And I get this question a lot. The truth is the donor-advised fund has been around for almost 100 years in the U.S., and yet most people haven't heard of it because a lot of the existing institutions that offer them mainly cater to the wealthy. So if you don't have a high-end accountant or financial advisor or wealth manager, you may not have heard of a donor-advised fund. But the easiest way to think of a donor-advised fund is that it's another type of tax-advantaged account. 401ks and IRAs are for retirement, right? 529 plans are for college. A donor-advised fund is a tax-advantaged account for giving to charity. And it has this amazing feature, which is that when you put money into the donor-advised fund, you immediately get that charitable deduction that everyone wants off their taxes. It's one of the most generous tax deductions out there. And then that money is invested tax-free into a range of different investment options. So the money grows over time. And then every time you're inspired to give, you just put into the service a recommendation of what charity to give some money to. It gets approved and it gets sent off to the charity. So it's really a fantastic financial product for people who want to put money aside for charity and who want to manage their taxes in terms of when they take those deductions.
And there are additional benefits of going through a donor advised fund instead of going directly to a charity. You're kept off some of those mailing lists, right, that you might get, you know, haunted for more contribution money, dollars in the future. What are the other big benefits from kind of going through the donor advised fund instead of going directly giving to one of your favorite charities?
Well, you brought up one of them for sure. There's definitely some benefits of just having a system for giving, for having it all in one place. You can control the communications to the nonprofits. A lot of people just love having all their tax receipts in one place. There's so many people who told us that one of their big stress points every year is at tax time finding their charitable donation receipts, right? And that all goes away with a donor advised fund. It's all in one place. But it turns out there actually are a lot of other benefits to donor advised funds. Like I said, first of all, when you have the money to put aside for charity, isn't necessarily when you've picked a charity to give that money to. And the wonderful thing about a donor advised fund is it separates those problems, right? You can put money aside when that's convenient for you financially, and you can give it away when it's convenient or when you're inspired to give. And so just separating those problems. But the tax benefits are a big deal. The charitable deduction is one of the most generous deductions out there, up to 60% of your adjusted gross income. And so a lot of people have variable income these days. They have good years and not so good years. Guess what happens in the good years? You have a higher tax rate. That's usually the year you want to put aside more money for charity and take that charitable deduction. And donor advised funds let you do that. But probably the biggest benefit of donor advised funds is when you start doing things like donating stock or even crypto these days. It could be an ETF, by the way. It could be a mutual fund. It's donating investments. Now, donating investments is incredibly valuable from a tax perspective, because when you donate investments, you save two ways. Not only do you get the charitable deduction, but you also never pay the capital gains on that investment, right? So if you bought Apple stock at $10 and now it's $100, when you donate that stock, you get the full charitable deduction for the current $100 value, and you never have to pay the $90 in capital gains taxes. So that's just phenomenal. The problem is most nonprofits can't take stock. They can't take crypto. They don't know what to do with an ETF or a mutual fund. I mean, in fact, there's over 1.5 million charities in the US, and only a few thousand know how to take investments as donations. And so that's the great thing about having a donor advised fund, is you can donate, whether it's cash, stock, ETFs, mutual funds, crypto, you name it, get that tax deduction, do the right thing. And the charities you support, they just get cash, and they don't have to operationally figure out how to deal with your ETF or mutual fund or whatever investment you're trying to donate.
So on that note, and I love that too, as donating those appreciated assets, avoiding tax on the one hand, and then also reducing your taxable income and reducing your tax exposure on the other side. Well, talk about being able to grow your money inside of a donor advised fund. To me, as someone who gets excited about, you know, watching their net worth grow and compounding returns, I was like, wait a second, I can compound my money to give away inside of this essentially tax sheltered account inside of a donor advised fund. And so I'll have more money to give away over the years. I'm giving consistently out of my donor advised fund every single year, but I'm also able to set aside some of it for bigger donations in the future. Talk about that, like the funds you can choose from, investing inside of a donor advised fund, and why that's so cool.
Yeah, well, it really is a wonderful feeling. I'm convinced some of it is psychological, around the fact that giving away money is actually a hard problem, right? Like we want to understand the organizations we're giving to. We want to know what benefits are coming from that money. And most people want to make good decisions when they're giving money. And the great thing about the donor advised fund is it takes away all the anxiety around that problem, because you know the money is invested. And to your point, it's invested tax-free. So we've seen this benefit for a lot of people in different ways. For some people, they have a big year. They got a big bonus. Maybe they're a real estate agent and they had a good year in the market. Maybe they're in tech and they got a stock benefit or something. But there's a lot of different reasons people end up with a better year than average. And so the idea of putting money aside, having it invested tax-free, you know, if you give the same amount of money to charity every year, you know, if you put aside 2, 3, or 5 years worth of giving at once, well, maybe the fund will grow enough to give you that sixth year or seventh year for free. And that feels great for people. Yeah. We know other people who think the way you were just describing, where they say, well, I don't have a lot of money now, but I'm going to put this money aside into a fund and build this up so that I can give more in the future to the organizations that I care about. And so that both of these are wonderful reasons why donor advised funds offer a range of investment options. And I mean, I'll tell you, at Daffy, of course, I know the name is cute. It stands for the donor advised fund for you. But at Daffy, we offer 14 different portfolios, everything ranging from money market funds and bonds. We have portfolios of Vanguard index funds. We have ESG portfolios. We even have crypto portfolios for people who are really tech forward and really aggressive. But fundamentally, regardless of what investment option you pick, the idea that your money is growing tax-free and can be used for good is just really powerful for a lot of people.
Yeah, I get that. And especially, I like what you said, like when there is a mismatch between the funds that you have on hand to give away and then a recipient of those funds, I think that donor advised funds can really, that there's a great problem being solved there. I guess what I'm trying to do now, though, is I'm trying to picture this from the standpoint of an organization that might need funding. Is there an argument that they might say, well, hey, don't invest that money. Like, if you want to give to us, give us the money now, because we could use that money now. We could put it to use. Maybe they're thinking, well, heck, maybe that person might change their mind down the road. Or is there, I guess, the potential argument for the perpetual kicking of the can down the road? Can you speak to that a little bit?
I think there's always worries and concerns and arguments about this, but the data has been pretty clear that when people put money aside for charity, they end up giving that money to charity. And most of the organizations that we talk to, their biggest struggle these days is not trying to get that one large donation. What most charities need is ongoing support, right? For most charities, if you gave them $1,000 this year versus giving them $100 every year for the next 10 years, for a lot of organizations, that $100 a year is more valuable because it's consistent.
They can count on
it. And what we see with donor-advised funds is that they really end up being a great anchor for people who make recurring donations. A lot of the reasons that people don't love the fundraising process is they don't love the sales-driven attempt to try and get you to make a donation now. It's very transactional, and it feels very intense and can be very sales-driven. The nice thing about having a donor-advised fund is you can be very intentional about your giving. If you support an organization, you can set up a recurring donation for them every quarter, every month, every year, and know that that's taken care of. But let's be clear, the research is very clear on the behavioral piece of this. People who set a goal, people who pre-commit to their giving, the way you do with a donor-advised fund, end up giving 32% more than people who just reach in their pocket. I mean,
nice.
You guys know this. I mean, the research is pretty clear on the retirement side, for example, right? Like, there's a reason why we don't just fund retirement, right, out of our pockets, right? There's a reason why we put aside money out of each paycheck, right, into that 401k, into that retirement account. Because it turns out setting that up on automatic leads us to save more for retirement. A lot of what Daffy is based on is the idea that that same process works for giving too. If you put aside money regularly for charity, it turns out you give more. And we think that's good for the whole ecosystem, including all of those organizations.
How do you think about which charities get your money, which charities get your donations? Because when you kind of look into the details of specific charities, not all of them are created equal, even if they have a similar mission, right? So some charities might be more efficient or less efficient. Some charities have come under fire, specifically charities run sometimes by professional athletes, maybe employing their friends or something like that to run the organization. And guess what? 40-something percent of the money you donate ends up in the hands or ends up actually impacting the cause that they purport to care about. So how do you think about researching, vetting charities, and which charities are worthy of donating money to?
I think there's a lot of anxiety that people have about that number, about the efficiency of organizations. Like I said, people take that decision very seriously, right? You work hard for your money. You work harder to even save some of that money. So when you're giving it away, you want it to have the most impact. And we hear that word over and over again from people. Where will my money have the most impact? And so I think one of the things people do is I do encourage them to look at those organizations. The hard part is, how do you learn about them? You know, what we've done at Daffy, but there's a number of services online that let you look up the operational efficiency, the history. I mean, one of the great things about the internet is you can get some of that information about those organizations. But I think giving has really shifted in the last 5 years. I think the pandemic permanently changed the way some people think about global versus local needs. One of the things that we've seen at Daffy is a real shift to people caring about local organizations that benefit their community, their neighbors, right? You know, you might be very passionate about food insecurity, but we've seen in the last 5 years people caring very much specifically about who's feeding people in need in their own area locally. In fact, one of the most popular features we rolled out during the pandemic was actually a feature to see which organizations are nearby. And whether they're focused on food insecurity or social justice or the environment or whatever cause speaks to you, we're seeing a lot of emphasis of people wanting to connect with organizations, not just with dollars, but also in person, right? Actually helping out directly. And when we talk to organizations, they say the same thing. They definitely need donations. They need financial support. But they also need people. They need volunteers. They throw events they need attendees for. They need board members. They need people who are not just, you know, focused on, you know, a check size or an amount, but actually on the cause itself and actually doing something to kind of help. In fact, we think this is one of the reasons that donor advised funds are growing in popularity, is this idea of not just talking about problems, but doing something to actually support organizations that are working on problems you care about.
That makes all the sense in the world. It's not just about throwing money at the problems, but showing up in real life. I think it goes a really long way, especially folks our the age of our generation.
IRL, but, baby.
Yeah. But Adam, we're going to talk more about donor advised funds. DAFI in particular, too, just how you were able to get it to be so affordable and so much more approachable for folks. We'll get to that and more right after this.
Cachava is the all-in-one superfood shake made up of high-quality plant-based nutrients. It's got greens, superfruits, plant proteins, antioxidants, adaptogens, probiotics, and in other words, everything your body craves to feel your best. This is where Cachava really earns their 52,000-plus five-star reviews. It tastes amazing. It's creamy and smooth with just water, and it comes in five delicious flavors. You can choose from chocolate, vanilla, chai, matcha, and coconut acai. Cachava is offering How to Money listeners 10% off for a limited time. I've been using Cachava in breakfast smoothies in the morning recently. It's just so nice to pack in a bunch of nutrients early in the a.m. in a way that's satisfying and energizing. So if you want to optimize your breakfast, your workout shake, be sure to check out Cachava. Just go to cachava.com/howtomoney. That's spelled K-A-C-H-A-V-A, and get 10% off your first order. That's K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com/howtomoney.
When it comes to financial advice, you got to trust the source. That's why you listen to this podcast. And if you're looking to upgrade your wallet, you need to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. If you're paying for vacations with whatever card is in your wallet, you could be missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table.
You can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade, lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions.
Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week at the beach every single summer. We've already got that trip to St. Simon's on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host. Or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. All right, we're back. We're still talking with Adam Nash, and we're talking about giving our money away. And you know what? Optimization is always nice on that front. Being able to give away more money than you actually socked away is really cool. Donor advised funds make that possible. And it feels like DAFI is actually leading the movement on that front. So you've really upset the apple cart on the donor advised front. You've lowered costs in a big way for consumers. Why was that so important to you to make it kind of inexpensive and accessible for people to actually, you know, start prioritizing that specific fund?
Well, listen, you know, DAFI was founded with this very simple mission, this idea that we could build software to help people be more generous more often, right? And so when you're looking at financial products, the donor advised fund is by and away the best financial product in this area, right? That ability to put money aside, get that tax deduction, have it invested tax-free, and then you can make a donation recommendation anytime you want. I mean, this is a really great type of account. But most people hadn't heard of it because the industry was focused on the wealthy. And why were they focused on the wealthy? I hate to say follow the money, but it turns out that most donor advised funds have the same business model as the investment services they're based on, which is they charge a percentage of assets. And so when you charge a percentage of assets, very quickly you start chasing bigger and bigger accounts, right? And it turns out billionaires have very big accounts, right? And so a lot of these services really ended up focused both on education and access on those wealthy individuals. I think Daffy has turned this on its head because we have taken a business model that's much more akin to what nonprofits use in general, which is a membership model, right? It's free to join Daffy. Most of our members pay $3 a month. We have a family plan at $5 a month. And we even have a high-end account for people who want to donate unlimited amounts of stock and crypto at $20 a month. But that idea of just having a simple, fair, transparent, flat rate, I know it sounds obvious, but in the donor advised fund industry, this is shaking up everything. Because in the traditional industry, right, you know, if you have a $100,000 account with Fidelity, if you decide to donate $10,000 of that, well, Fidelity just lost 10% of their revenue off the account. And so I think a lot of the problems you see in the existing industry of warehousing assets and only pursuing wealthy individuals, I think is just an outcome of their business model. And so at Daffy, we really want to change that. We decided to build a platform that was focused on people, not dollars. And so our goal is really to reach those 60 million American households who give to charity every year and say, hey, there's actually this better account. There's a better way to do that. You can save money on taxes and have more money for the organizations you support. And so I think people are really excited about that. I think the donor advised fund is going to be the next hot account in the US, just like 529 plans were or IRAs were 50 years ago. I think that this is growing rapidly.
And what you're doing with Daffy, it's not just about reducing costs and making it more approachable for the masses, but you make it fun as well. And we touched on this about the kind of the behavioral finance side of things. You're talking about how you're celebrating the deposits that folks are setting up. You've got badges and confetti. How do you think about modernizing giving and making it less frustrating? Because it's interesting that some of the same techniques that you're using, like these are the same psychological, I don't want to say ploys, but that companies put to use on us as we're trying to buy stuff or as they're trying to sell stuff to us. And when you think about it, at the end of the day, the same thing's happening, right? If you're looking at your net worth is going down when you contribute a whole, you know, a whole lot of money or when you spend a whole lot of money. But like you said earlier, there's a great argument that, oh no, there's a big difference between giving money away and spending it on yourself. There's something that's much more noble and altruistic and
fulfilling.
Fulfilling and others focused. But just talk about that, I guess, just how you've kind of modernized it and made it to where we're sort of capturing some of these psychological elements that make us, in addition to the good that we're providing, also want to continue to give our money away.
Well, I love this point, and this is actually a big part of our product philosophy at Daffy, which is, listen, we have an industry that's made it, they celebrate and they give you incentives to spend more, you know, incentives when you save. I mean, if we can show you confetti when you buy a stock, we can show you confetti when you give money to an organization that deserves it. And so a lot of what we've done in Daffy is stopped treating it like a boring savings account and treating it what it is, which is a really great thing. And frankly, we do a lot in the application to encourage you, right? Like, I mean, a lot of us use Apple Health or these other apps that help you get your steps in or make sure you're working out or eating right. I mean, we've done a lot in the last 10 to 15 years to help people hit all these different goals they have. Why not apply that to your goal for giving? Right? Why not incentivize people there? So we spend a lot of time making the app fun and enjoyable for people because we make it great for people to give. We think they'll give more. But also, I will say the other great thing about Daffy and the app is that giving is one of the few financial tasks that we do, which isn't really solitary, right? Giving is something we tend to do with other people. People care about the organizations they support. But we don't talk about giving enough, right? Do you know what organizations even your friends and family give to?
Yeah, not usually.
Most of us never talk about it. And the great thing about the Daffy experience is that you can actually follow other people and learn about organizations. I've learned in my local area about a number of organizations purely from what my friends and colleagues give to. And so what we've done a lot in the app is try and bring in the idea of community, this idea that, you know, you don't know all the great organizations out there. You know, we have the friends that we turn to are experts in sports or experts in money or experts in tech. You know, we actually have friends and colleagues who spend a lot of time thinking about where to give money or what organizations to support. And we're hoping that DAFI becomes a place where people can share that information. We actually ask everyone who makes a donation on DAFI, it's optional, mind you, but we ask everyone who makes a donation on DAFI to leave a public comment, a note about why they support that organization. I mean, this is incredible information. I've been working on the internet for more than 20 years, but this content, you know, people give to organizations because they had a parent that passed away who always supported that organization. Or they had someone they cared about who had a health problem, and so they support an organization that supports finding a cure for that problem. It could be a school that they went to when they were younger, or that their kids attend. There's so many reasons people give, but it's kind of in the shadows. And so we spend a lot of time on DAFI encouraging people to share that information, because what we see is that it inspires others to give.
Mm. Yeah, and the new-ish, I guess, campaigns feature that you guys have too, where someone can say, hey, listen, I'll match every dollar that you are willing to donate to my favorite charity. It helps other people learn about a charity, but then it also incentivizes getting other people in on the process. So I love that. Matt and I have railed about the downsides of kind of the social mediaification of investing apps, because often it's leading people astray, but in this case, it's leading people towards the altruistic, the good.
Goodness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's right, because just because a stock is a hot stock or in the press or everyone's talking about it, if anything, that might indicate that it's not
right.
A great exactly. investment for the long term. But giving is different, right? We look for trust in these organizations. We look for examples. But you're right, the campaigns feature has been very, very exciting. We just rolled that out a few months ago. But that's a great example about how we're innovating in the area. No other donor advised fund does this. But internet campaigns have been around for a long mm-hmm. time, right? People have run things to raise money for this, that, and whatever. And donor advised funds have been around for a long time. And so we kind of said, hey, what if you could run an internet campaign, but instead of just raising money, you could use that money you put aside for charity to match everyone's donations? Like, we're used to celebrities doing this, right? We're used to famous people doing these matching campaigns, but what if everyone could do that? And it's really phenomenal. We see people raising money for schools. They raise money for food banks. One of the reasons we built the feature was actually we had a member who came to us, and they had a family member who passed away. And they wanted to raise money for an organization that person had spent their life kind of supporting. And we thought that was such a wonderful idea. It kind of went into kind of our calculus of how could we make the Donor Advised Fund even better? How could we help people who had put aside money for charity inspire others to give? And so, yeah, the DAFI campaigns has been phenomenally popular, and we tried to make it incredibly easy to do, right? So you can go to DAFI, sign up, fund a campaign, and get started in a matter of minutes.
Very cool. It harnesses some of that telethon energy from back in the day. Adam, we're big fans of DAFI, what it is that y'all are doing, how we can more strategically give our money away. And personally, I haven't checked out that local search feature, so I'm going to be checking that out myself. Folks can learn more about DAFI just by heading over to DAFI.org. Is that right?
Yep, that's right.
Awesome. All right. Well, Adam, seriously, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. And yeah, hope to talk to you soon.
Yeah, it was wonderful to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right, Matt, that was a great conversation. And it's also really heartening to know that even people with 150 IQs, they still need personal finance education. Like, we don't come
for all you smarties out there.
That's right.
Don't tune out.
It doesn't matter how smart you are. Like, you don't come out of the womb knowing this stuff. Some of the basics are just easily understandable, but then how do you practice those in reality, and what does it look like? There's a lot of discussion needed around those topics, and that's like what we care about, and that's what we try to do every week here on this show.
That's right.
But what was your big takeaway from our conversation with Adam?
My big takeaway, it's back when we were talking about the personal finance class that he teaches, and it was specifically when he was talking about his students and getting them to think through the careers and the jobs that they're going to take. Maybe the question that you should be asking yourself is, what kind of life do you want to build for yourself? And I think that can not only apply to the work that you're doing, but also to the money that you're giving away, the types of organizations that you're giving away to, but then just the very act, the very discipline of giving money away. Like, do you want to be a generous person? Who do you want to be? What kind of life do you want to lead? Oh, you want to take this type of work? Okay, well, know that this is what these are the type of hours that being a doctor is going to require of you. I don't even know what... I can't give an example, but like I know, like they're on call, and you know, there's certain periods of time when you're doing the night shift or you're on for 20 hours or something like that. It's important to keep through some of these practical matters. It almost seems kind of basic, but that determines what your days look like, and therefore what your life ultimately ends up looking like. And I think that that's a great question to remind ourselves of. What do you want your life to look
like? And money's a part of that equation, but it's not the end all be all. There's a lot.
Yep.
There's a lot of other things that influence what we want our lives to look like. And so,
totally.
Yeah, you have to think about the trade-offs of those decisions. It makes me think I'm reading a book right now, a biography of Walt Disney, and his home life isn't so great, because he has chosen to build a life that revolves around his work. And that produced a lot of movies that people really love over a lot of years. But it also made home life tenuous, difficult.
Sure.
And he wasn't there very much. So,
and that's, in this case, I hate to say that that's fine. Because it seems like, oh man, seems like that's something that you want to prioritize over anything else, right? Like a role that only you can fulfill as, let's say, a father, right?
Yeah.
But it's so important to go into these transactions essentially with your eyes wide open to know what it is that you're getting into.
Yeah.
I think, what about you?
I think my big takeaway was at the very beginning, speaking of actually building a business, when we asked him that question, and he said that nothing stands still and you can't just do the same thing year after year and hope that your business succeeds. You have to iterate. And that's because the marketplace is ever shifting. Consumer tastes are ever changing. As we build this podcast and this business, it just makes me think, okay, cool. What is it that we need to iterate on? What is it that we need to change? And I think it's good advice for anybody out there who wants to start building something. Your initial concept might be great, and you might even find success immediately. But then, how do you build on that success? It's probably not going to look the same in year three as it did in year one.
That's true. All right, man. Let's get back to the beer. You and I enjoyed a Frou Frou Gal, which is a spring saison. This was donated to the show by Graham, and this is also brewed by Graham.
That's
this
right.
A home brew. But yeah, what were your thoughts on it, buddy?
Yeah, we met Graham at a listener hang down in Atlanta. He was generous enough to bring us this.
At another great beer spot.
Yeah.
Inner Voice.
Indicator.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, beer and pizza. So good.
Yeah. And then so Graham makes his own. He said, oh, I'll bring you one of my home brews. Dude, this one was great. And not to hate on Graham, I did not have high expectations just because I typically don't have high expectations for homebrewed beers. This one was really, really good. I love a good saison, especially like, man, springtime's coming. Like it's fresh. It's floral. It's yeasty. So, yeah, I was a big fan of what this was bringing to the table. Graham knocked it out of the park.
Graham, thanks so much for donating this one to the show. We'll make sure to link to anything we mentioned today in our conversation with Adam Nash. You can head to howtomoney.com. Find the links there, as well as more information on Daffy and how it is that you can give your money more strategically.
Yeah, we've even got an article on the site about donor advised funds in general, about Daffy specifically. We'll link to those in the show notes, too. So, Matt, that's going to do it for this episode. Until next time. Best friends out.
Best friends out.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health 8 kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. It's a literal pro, and it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health 8 Kombucha today.
Supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. All you do is start with a prompt. You describe your presentation in a few words, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides that you can then customize in seconds.
Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation with AI.
Generate slides in seconds with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
Upswell Marketing would like to remind you that when customers choose your small business, they're really choosing you. So focus on super serving your existing customers and let Upswell handle the pipeline generation of new leads and customers.
Upswell specializes in developing customized direct response campaigns and is now offering a no-obligation free assessment of your current marketing strategies.
Not to mention, new customers also receive 15% off their first order when they mention that they heard about Upswell on this podcast. For more information, visit upswellmarketing.com. That's upswellmarketing.com.